Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, Rick Stout, who is an architect with Stout Architecture. Hi, Rick. How are you today?
I'm good, John. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure having you, Rick. You've been on the program before, and it's always a delight. Now, you're an award-winning architect for a number of years now. But prior to architecture, you were a ceramic potter. Do you think pottery had any influence with you becoming an architect, or do you see it as influencing any of your architecture?
Well, sure. You know, I came to architecture in a roundabout way.
Yeah, it seems that way.
I went to college initially to study aeronautical technology and become a pilot. That was my real dream since I was a kid. And frankly—
Did you want to be like a Sully?
Well, yeah. I wanted to be a commercial airline pilot.
Wow.
I loved flying. I got my license in high school and went to college with a private pilot's license and actually had an airplane in college, a tiny one that was probably less valuable than most of my classmates'
cars,
Mustangs, and so on. But it provided opportunities for me that very few people have, so I'm very fortunate that way. Anyway, I decided at the time— was Vietnam was in full swing and military was the best way to achieve that goal. Those people I knew who didn't take the military route had a lot of trouble, so I decided that maybe that wasn't the career for me. And architecture was, frankly, the farthest thing from my mind then.
But were you doing—
I didn't even know how to spell it.
Were you doing pottery at the time? I mean—
While I was in college, an old childhood friend's parents worked for the University of Southern California, and they had a ceramics program at a summer college campus called Isomata, which is in the mountains above Palm Springs, not too far from their USC campus. And I got a job there, a work-study job, and studied ceramics there for the 2 years before I got my undergraduate degree, and then went back there right after college and moved to Idlewild. Lived in a teepee and worked there in the summer and studied ceramics with Susan Peterson at USC. Very special opportunity.
Wow.
So it did, because those people that I met in California and those who I became associated with led me in that direction. I had a few side paths too, but eventually went back to California. I moved to Vermont for a year in 1975 and 6 and helped my family open an inn, convert an old building, a beautiful old building, turn of the century, Queen Anne-style building, into a restaurant and inn. And the process of doing that, becoming involved in the building part, so intrigued me that when we opened the restaurant, I didn't like the restaurant business and went back to California to my sort of core group of friends who were by then building houses and all kinds of trades. So that's how I got into the building business. I went back to California and started, kind of gave up my pottery business. Actually, I left it to my sister in Vermont and went back to California and started in with the trades. I started framing houses, carpentry, electric,
holding a hammer,
roofing,
doing the whole nine yards.
All of those, yep.
Right. Wow.
I've always been a mechanic my whole life, taking things apart and putting them back together. So it was perfect for me. And towards the end of the 70s, 79, my first wife decided that she wanted to finish her undergraduate degree and wanted to move to L.A. to do it. And I lived in the mountains in paradise. I didn't want to go to the city. So I asked my architect friend, who I was working for at the time, what I should do. He said, "Why don't you go to architecture school?" I said, "What?"
What? Bingo, though, right?
That was in August. By September, the early September, because they were in a quarter system, so they started a little differently, I was enrolled at Cal Poly in Pomona and going to a graduate architecture program, which was 4 years of the most intensive work of my lifetime.
4 years?
4 years. They called it a pattern 3 program, which was ended in a master's degree. So we didn't have to take the, all the core of the undergraduate stuff. So, but it still took 4 years and it was very, very difficult.
Intensive, right. Yeah. But it obviously gave you a good base.
I love architecture. I love my work. I loved going to school. I loved working that hard. Well, maybe not all the time. But,
let me ask you, what you're living out here in the Hamptons, and it's a special place. What makes it a special place for you, you know, being a resident and also being a professional architect?
It's a special place in that every architect on the planet is dying to have a project here, if not live and work here. So I'm very lucky in that way that I do. When I moved here, there were a half a dozen active architects and maybe a dozen who were around that we knew about. And now there are over 100 licensed architects who are AIA members alone and maybe another 50 or so who
in
aren't
the Hamptons?
AIA members.
That's correct. Wasn't aware of that.
On the Two Forks in,
wow.
In this AIA Peconic, the American Institute of Architects Peconic chapter.
Well, didn't you start that also?
I did. I was the founding president for that in 2006.
So what, there were six of you guys basically?
Well, no, there
beginning?
Were a half a dozen back in the 80s when right. I moved here in 85. So I've been here 30 years. And by the time I started, there were about 80. So things changed a lot in those
that time
15
frame.
To 20
right.
years. A wow. lot of architects moved here and builders, of course, and the realtors who support that whole system.
Of course.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a real deal. Like,
well, you're an LL, wait a second, let me get this right, LEED, a LEED architect, correct? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, I'm an accredited LEED architect.
LEED, thank you.
LEED.
Right. Now, what's entailed in being a LEED architect?
The United States Green Building Council has a program called LEED, and it's an acronym for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. So that's where the word LEED comes from. It's not Leeds. That's a city in England.
Right.
So LEED is a system of scoring points for new buildings and sometimes renovations, often commercial and public buildings, but there's also programs for houses and all kinds of buildings, even community planning. And it's a program that encourages sustainability at every level, from even the planning stages to finding a site that's not a brownfield site, or not a green site, rather, not a park or someplace important, but someplace that needs to be redeveloped or rehabbed. So there's every single aspect of the construction process, from the site selection to the interior surfaces and products that go into the building. The energy, of course, is a big part of it. You want to save energy in terms of mechanical equipment and insulation, solar orientation to take advantage of the sun, right down to the very last thing that goes into the building. Every aspect of it is considered in terms of sustainability.
Now, I know there are different grades, so I imagine as you get up from what's the lowest grade? Bronze to?
It's certified is the lowest grade. It's just a certification.
Oh, I see.
And then the next one is silver, gold, and platinum.
And platinum.
So there's four levels.
So that's okay. Now, how can somebody get in touch with you, Rick?
The best way is to look at my website, Stott Architecture with a T, STOTT. And, you'll find all my contact information on there. My phone, my office phone is 631-283-1777. And my email is Rick, R-I-C, without a K, at stottarchitecture.com.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the program, Rick. This is John Christopher, and you're listening to Real Life, the show that talks about the people, places, and things that are the heartbeat and pulse of life here in the Hamptons. We'll be right back after the short break with our next guest, Apple Bank manager and Sag Harbor Community Band member, Tom Rickenbach.
Support for 88.3 comes from Sotheby's International Realty, local experts worldwide. With over 100 international offices, Sotheby's has four Hamptons locations in Southampton, Bridgehampton, Easthampton, and Sag Harbor. Learn more at john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have the Sag Harbor Community Band member and also the manager of the Apple Bank in Sag Harbor, Tom Rickenbach. Tom, how are you today?
I'm good, John. How are you? We go back a long way, don't we?
We do. I you know, that's funny you should say that, because one of my things I was wondering about, where did you grow up?
I grew up in East Hampton, actually. Went to East Hampton High School and really only left the area to go to college and have been back here ever since I basically graduated.
So have you seen any changes along the way?
Oh, boy. That's a lot of questions. Yeah, lots have changed since I've grown up. You know, when you're here full time, though, the changes aren't as noticeable as if you left for a while and came back, I'm sure. So,
oh, right.
But it certainly has changed quite a bit. I don't think anybody would deny that.
Were you here when the Black Buoy was in existence in Sag Harbor?
Oh, yeah. No, I grew up
in 1963.
I've seen quite a bit. Yeah.
You were there?
Yes.
And you saw Paul Newman. Was it Paul Newman that went there, or the one of those guys, one of those stars at that time?
Oh, yeah, no, I never actually went to the Black Buoy myself, I know it was there.
Okay, great. So now, are you residing in Sag Harbor, or are you still in East Hampton?
I bought a house in Bridgehampton in 1994, so just coming up on 25 years there.
Wow, that's great. So. That is great. So, okay, let's talk about the community band, the Sag Harbor Community Band. When did it first come into existence?
Well, the Sag Harbor Community Band was formed in 1957. There was a village anniversary in Sag Harbor.
That's before you were born.
Before I was born, for a couple of years. And they had some celebrations for Sag Harbor's anniversary on that year and realized that they did not have a community band at that time. So one of the local school music teachers, Pop Mazzio, formed the band at the end of 1957, and it's been going on ever since.
That is amazing. Now, did you, having gone to school, you must have learned how to play the trombone in school.
Started on trumpet in fourth grade, but then changed to trombone in fifth grade, and been playing it ever since fifth grade.
Wow. That's amazing. So what happened? After high school, you said you went to college, I assume, or...
I went to the University of Delaware for 4 years.
Did you play band there?
I played in the marching band, much different than high school marching band, but it was an experience I will never forget.
No kidding. What sense?
It's a huge band, much bigger than anything you ever experience out here. Very regimented, very intricate, and very organized, and it was a lot of fun. I really, really
enjoyed it. So a lot of precision
work. A lot of precision, yeah. I found some of my old formation charts that they give us when we're putting together a show, and it was really interesting to look at that again.
So the music director does that, or does he have somebody else?
Yeah, they choreograph the whole halftime show, and everybody gets their full sheet of where they're laid out, and their section is indicated, and you will pretty much play the music and march from one space to another, and it looks like a moving picture from the spectators.
Now,
side.
Do you have to rehearse it quite a bit, or is
you rehearse quite a bit?
Oh, yeah, so it's not really like okay, here's the chart, go out there and walk around.
You rehearse quite a bit, yeah, and to get a handful of shows in, because not all of your games are home games, a lot of them are away, so you only have a limited number of shows to learn, but it's a lot of work.
Jeez,
really is.
That is amazing. So now you came back out of school, you're back here. How did you get the calling to go to the Sag Harbor Community Band?
Well, I had some customers at the bank who were in the band, and I would talk about it with them, and I did play with a summer band in East Hampton through college, and it stopped playing in East Hampton at that time. But I always knew the band in Sag Harbor was there. I just didn't have the time to do so much. And I talked to a couple customers, and they said, you know, come on down. And so I came down one Tuesday night, and it was 28 years ago.
Do you have to audition, or they say, here's the chart?
Auditioning is very loosely defined phrase. But as you know, it, pretty much if you can handle playing the music without too much difficulty, we pretty much allow people to stay to the extent that they're willing to put up with whatever new music that's thrown at them.
Well, that's a good question that you bring up from the standpoint. How often do you guys rehearse and do you learn new songs along the way?
We do learn new songs. The only rehearsals we do are prior to the July-August concert season. We start practicing March, April. It's every Tuesday until July, and then July and August, it's concerts only. So we have to learn everything we're going to play up until July, and then we have no more real practice.
Oh, so it's like, is it every week that you're performing?
Basically, it's every Tuesday between the end of March and September, either rehearsals or the concerts in July and August. And then we take a few week break, and then we rehearse again for a holiday concert that we play every December. So that's, again, maybe a new piece or two, pulling some pieces out of our folder from one year to the next to give it variety, but that's our holiday concerts in December.
Now, who's the music director now?
Our music director for the past 6 to 7 years is a gentleman by the name of David Brandenburg. He lives in Amagansett. He took over for a previous director who, after 30 years, decided to move down to Kentucky with his family. And
I'm going to take the band with me?
If we all could have gone, you would have gone. Because Fred Hines is a fantastic man, but he was a fantastic director for us. We were sort of left with a vacancy that we didn't know how we were going to fill. And after some searching around town, David presented himself, and it's like he's been with us forever. He's amazing, challenges us, gives us new music, tweaks the old music so he keeps it fresh, and really is a great guy.
So it's a fun thing. You enjoy
really,
this.
I really do.
That is fascinating.
It sort of takes me away from anything else going on and just allows me to focus on the music. And we have a lot of stalwart spectators that come every week, whether the weather's good or not so good. And we play to about an average about 150 people every week who sit in the roadway in their folding chairs and watch the band.
And you perform where, in front of the VFW?
In front of the American Legion building on Bay Street. That's every Tuesday night from 8 to 9 between July and August, basically. It's 4th of July to Labor Day, but it's July and August is easier to say.
Now, do you get compensated?
No, it's completely voluntary
membership.
Even
the music director?
Well, we do have to pay the music director, yes. We did not have to pay a music director for 30 years, so we were not sure what the
So where does the money come from?
It comes from donations, basically. We pass the hat at all of our concerts. You know, I apply for grants where they're available. I'm the treasurer also, but we work on trying to get donations that way. And basically, it's public input, so it's always a challenge.
Very apropos time to say, where can somebody donate? Because I think it's such a vital part of the community.
Well, the most direct answer is come to our concert and let us pass the hat to you, and you can donate that way.
You can donate a check. Would you take a check?
Checks, cash, anything like, you know, fine jewelry, anything you like.
Bitcoin?
Bitcoin we haven't gotten into yet, but give us time. We have a website, sagharborband.org, which does allow PayPal donations. But you could also mail the check if you would like to our P.O. Box 1925 in Bridgehampton and indicate that it's for the band. Actually, when we've lost some band members over the years, it seems to generate a handful of donations in memory of that person, which is also we're very grateful for that.
Was Dave Lee? I remember Dave Lee was a big part of...
Dave Lee was in the band for a great number of years. He played drums for a while and then changed his direction and was our MC for the longest time. We've missed Dave terribly since he passed. So, but he's been with us a long time as well.
Wow. So how can somebody get in touch with you? Like at the bank, Apple Bank, right?
Well, Apple Bank, as far as the band, Sag Harbor Community Band at yahoo.com is an easy way. We're on Facebook. Please like our Facebook page. Just search for Sag Harbor Community Band. As far as the bank is concerned, my local number at the branch is 631-725-2200. And I'd love to talk to you about anything involving the band or the bank.
Okay. I'm so happy you came on the program, Tom Rickenbach.
This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back after the short break with our next guest. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, Duncan Darrow, who is the founder of Fighting Chance. Duncan, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. It's nice being on your show.
Can you tell our audience, what is Fighting Chance?
Yeah, we are a free cancer counseling center. We were founded in 2002, and we're based in Sag Harbor, right above Geek Hampton. Next year, 2017, will be our 15th anniversary. So we're staffed by healthcare professionals, clinical psychologists, oncology social workers, and if you're diagnosed with cancer in any of the five East End towns, you can call us, come in for an appointment, and you will basically be set up with a counselor who you will see weekly for about 4 months. At the end of that time, you should have kind of regained your sea legs for your cancer journey and be well on your way towards a therapy that hopefully is successful. And it's all free of charge.
Right. What a wonderful concept. The thing I'm thinking about is, how did this come about? How did you come up with the idea for Fighting Chance?
It started in 2001. I lived out in Sag Harbor part of the time. My mother lived here full time. She got lung cancer. She lived for 100 days. After the diagnosis, I was her main caregiver, and we were just lost at sea. The well-meaning folks at Southampton Hospital really were not set up to offer you counseling about the psychological impact about the disease, about the financial issues that you would face, and the family issues. It was your basic, 1,000 questions with no answers. So
right.
After my mom passed away, I thought, why did I try to do something? I was in hospice as a volunteer for a while and said, gee, you're great, but rather than take care of people with cancer at the very end, why don't you take care of people at the beginning?
Right. What a wonderful thing. Yeah.
They said, we can't do it. There's too much paperwork. And I said, what's it about? And I said, it's mostly about who's going to pay for stuff. So I said, well, if it's free, I guess that would cut down on the paperwork. And I said, it would.
And it did.
And it did. It's amazing.
That's fantastic. So I know there are three elements involved in the course of a cancer treatment. And can you elaborate on them?
Yeah, you're talking about the medical treatment or the treatment that you receive at our charity.
Well, at your charity, what takes place?
Yeah, so what basically happens, after 15 years, most doctors on the East End are familiar with Fighting Chance. Many of them have been on our board and so forth. So it all starts with kind of three of the worst words that I think anyone ever would want to hear. You have cancer.
Right.
And that is uttered by perhaps your primary care physician because he was suspicious about something. He got a test and the results showed you had cancer, maybe from an oncologist. And most of them pretty much tell patients to see us right away because they know that the negative psychological impact of the disease is going to be very serious, and that if a patient can get some help coping with that, maintain a positive attitude, maintain their ability to digest information and make informed decisions, they'll be better off. So we see about 250 patients a year, mostly being referred from the medical community.
And are they coming from the five towns?
Yeah, it's pretty much the five towns. We will go a little beyond that, in a special case, but the five towns keep us pretty busy. When someone comes in, they're assigned to a counselor. We have three counselors are all licensed, insured, and been doing this for, years and years. And you typically see a counselor once a week for, as I say, about 4 weeks. We give you a guide called Coping with Cancer on the East End, which is kind of like a where to find it yellow pages for what you'll need. And we typically recommend that you join a support group, which meets twice a month. So that's kind of the package in a nutshell.
Right, right. Well, it sounds very, very supportive. I mean, it sounds like a wonderful thing. I just heard that over the weekend I was listening on NPR, and there was a doctor talking about how the path for treatment has changed. That he recalls one time that a nurse was sent in to the patient to give the wonderful news of having cancer instead of the doctor himself addressing it. And I think we've evolved a little bit since then.
Yeah, I mean, Frankie, when we started out in 2002, a little alleyway next to the American Hotel and kind of a lobster shack, cancer was really whispered And patients, many of the patients that came in to see us were embarrassed that they had the disease and really did not want people in the community to know about it. Whereas now, 15 years later, I think it's more out in the open, like a lot of things, and that's healthy. Back in the dark ages, in the 1960s or something, doctors would not even tell patients they had cancer. They would make up another reason for their illness because it was so difficult to treat that they figured why get them depressed with a cancer diagnosis.
Right, makes sense. Well, I mean, at the time, right?
So, yeah, at the time it made sense. Now, of course, there have been a lot of advances in care, and we're you know, on the maybe the eve of a real golden age in terms of the science.
Yeah,
that could really make a much bigger dent in the disease.
Right. There's a new generation of cancer drugs out there called
immunotherapy.
Right. So how does that work?
Well, immunotherapy, a couple different ways. Some immunotherapy drugs, they inject them like a shot in your body, and they find your T cells, which are the killer cells, the backbone of your immune system. And to keep it simple, they sort of jazz them up. It's like giving them steroids. That's the metaphor. And they then go off and attack cancer cells, as a much more fearsome force than they were before. And then there's another set of therapies where they take your T cells, your killer cells, out of your body and juice them up in a petri dish, so to speak, put them back in, and once again, it's a fearsome force to attack your cancer cells.
Wow, that's amazing, the progress in medical science, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It's
now, speaking of progress, you've teamed up with Bob Chanlinier of the Southampton Hospital to start building the new Southampton Cancer Center, and it's supposed to be a full-fledged cancer center. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, it's in our latest newsletter, which you can see on our website, fightingchance.org. But I'm very fond of Bob. We've worked together on a number of projects over the years. And the hospital was blessed about a year ago with a very, very large philanthropic gift, which has permitted them to purchase the land across from the Ford dealership on 27. And the center has been designed. I think a shovel goes in the ground in a few months. And Bob has been nice enough to say that he would like Fighting Chance to have a satellite office there on a rent-free basis, because he now kind of sees that, the psychological support for patients really does go hand-in-hand with radiation or clinical oncology and so forth.
So it's everything in one fell swoop.
Yeah, all under one roof. And then if you've got to go into New York, as you probably know, Jeff Lynch, who owns the Hampton Jitney, we do a program with them where we raise half the money, they give half the money, but we give away 1,000 jitney tickets a year to patients that have to go to Memorial Sloan Kettering.
That is great. Obviously, Fighting Chance is a worthwhile cause. If someone wanted to donate or volunteer, how could they do that?
Easiest thing is you can call our office, 631-725-4646, or you can go on our website, fightingchance.org. There's a landing page to donate, and there's another landing page to volunteer. We need a lot of volunteers calling out for volunteers, because next year's our 15th anniversary, and we have a lot of wonderful programs planned to, thank the community for supporting us, all this time.
Duncan Darrow, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You have been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people, places, and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, broker associate with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life is also brought to you in part by LEAP Compliance, HR's one-stop solution for sexual harassment prevention training and policies. All employers in the New York State are now required to train all employees annually, no matter the size of the company. For more information, discriminationpreventiontraining.com or 646-216-8038.